I've been covering Srimad Bhagavatam in sequence, verse after verse, and in chapter 24, canto 3. And do you have a recording device? You have a phone. You're recording.
Yes.
So can you make an arrangement that this gets to him and he can send it to Mother Mongol? Mother Mongol, Chicago?
Someone there.
We'll find out. Okay. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So, little context. This is Chapter 24 is the renunciation of Kardama Muni, which means Kardama Muni is going to leave his grahastha ashram and go to the forest and resume what he was doing before he was married, his practices of Satya Yoga, meditation, and taking his mind on Lord Vishnu, and so forth. The previous chapter is Devahuti's lamentation, just to give a context. She, having been married to Kardama Muni for tens of thousands of years, she intuitively understands what's going on within her husband's contemplations. He's going to leave. And she laments that I haven't taken proper advantage of the association of you, as I've been thinking of you as my husband, and she describes herself in ways that are just very humble. My thoughts have been towards my happiness and sense gratification and so forth and so on, although they've been living a life of extreme austerity. Is not a life of sense gratification. But she's speaking of herself that way. And the message, the theme is, through association of sadhu, how one can become elevated to the stage of perfection. So she's asking specifically and repeatedly, please grant me liberation. Because you have the power, you yourself in that position, please grant me that qualification, because my thoughts and my consciousness is entangled in the temporary. Please grant me that benediction. In so many ways of saying the same thing. Which says, in our lives, that's this liberation doesn't mean sayuja or negation of the material. It's attaining the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord in loving service. She knows that. And of course, she also knows, because her husband told her and Lord Brahma confirmed, that she will have as her son the personality of Godhead. And through her son, she will receive that perfection. So that's how chapter 24 begins. That was 23, Devahuti's lamentation. Kardama Muni says, basically, cheer up, Devahuti. Don't go into this lamentation thing. You're highly qualified. Lord Brahma said, Lord Vishnu confirmed that as your son, the personality of Godhead will be born. You have undertaken sacred vows. God will bless you. Hence you should worship the Lord with great faith. Through sensory control, religious observances, austerities, and gifts of your money and charity. Now, he addresses her as, O princess, alluding to the fact that she's the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, so she's from a Kshatriya position. Previously she was living in fantastic opulence, which she's given up to be with her husband in the forest. So she has no opulence, she has no charity to give. You give your money in charity. She has other kinds of riches, that's her. As the saying goes, austerity is the wealth of a brahmana. So she's a princess, but she's been with her brahmana husband, and so she has that wealth of her husband, her austerities, because of serving her husband in that way. In any case, it's a principle of detachment in order to take shelter of transcendence. And there are sub-religious principles that he's indicating. Sensory control, religious observances, austerities, and gifts of your money and charity. Worship the Lord with great faith, observing those sub-religious principles. Mode of goodness, becoming perfected by the mind going to the Personality of Godhead. So that's his advice to her. The Personality of Godhead, being worshipped by you, will spread my name and fame. He will vanquish the knot of your heart by becoming your son and teaching you knowledge of Brahman. Brahma Bhavana. So Jiva Goswami explains in his Sandarbhas that when the Vedas use the word Brahman, it's implied that it's Bhagavan, because Brahman is a feature of Bhagavan. Without Bhagavan, you don't have Brahman. Brahmano hi pratishtaham. I'm the basis of Brahman. So whenever the word Brahman is used, as is being used here, it means Bhagavan, the Personality of Godhead. He's not unclear. And she's a great devotee also. Before their marriage, Lord Vishnu said, "For to have me as your son, which is your desire, you'll require a wife as qualified as yourself, and she's going to come here in 2 or 3 days. She's as qualified as you are." So she's pure devotee, not just princess. But his advice is, fix your mind in devotion upon the Personality of Godhead with these sub-religious principles as part of the frame of your life, and the Personality of Godhead will appear as your son, he will spread my fame, and he'll give you transcendental knowledge, knowledge of Brahman. And then, verse 5, we're going to 6. So, the speaker, this section of the Bhagavatam, follows from the earlier parts of Canto 3. It's Maitreya speaking to Vidura. Because in the beginning part of Canto 3, Maitreya meets Vidura. Excuse me. Maitreya is present when Krishna is speaking Uddhava Gita. Maitreya goes in a northerly direction. Vidura is told by Uddhava, go take shelter of Maitreya. That was the Lord's intention. He said it before he departed. So Vidura found Maitreya. He's inquiring for Maitreya so many things. Maitreya is speaking to Vidura. Maitreya said, Devahuti was fully faithful and respectful toward the direction of her husband, Kardama, who was one of the Prajapatis, or generators of human beings in the universe. Oh, great sage, Maitreya says to Vidura, oh, great sage. She thus began to worship the master of the universe, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was situated in everyone's heart. Again, this is Satya Yoga. Dhyan is the process of meditation. So, it's described later in chapter 26 that this Dhyan, or the process of Satya Yoga, leads to devotional service. It doesn't just stop with meditation on Supersoul. It leads to devotional service. The Bhagavan conception is the goal, or is the object, and the goal is devotional service to this personality Godhead. So she's following the process that she knows very well. She learned it from her husband. Text 6. Oh, and one other thing. Nice point. There's a part of the necessity for the practitioner of bhakti, by in whatever the age, there must be complete faith in the person who one is receiving instructions from. I mean, in order to come to the stage of perfection. Reference, there's a very nice reference that I came across recently. It's from Padma Purana. Padma Purana has a whole big section called Bhagavat Mahatmya. It's specifically glorifying Bhagavat Purana. It's a long story, because it's a Purana, that they just skip the long story. The agents of Vishnu have come, similar to the Ajamila story, they've come to rescue somebody that was fallen, wicked, sinful, and become a ghost, and they came to take him back to Godhead. And the people in the assembly saw them and said, well, wait a minute. What about all the other people that were hearing the Bhagavatam? And here's this ghost who was terribly sinful before he became a ghost, and he's going back to Godhead. So how come he's going back to Godhead and the others aren't going back to Godhead? And the agents of Lord Vishnu say, it's a qualitative matter how you hear the Bhagavatam. And then they indicate what those qualifications are to receive the fullness of the Bhagavatam. And the first one in their list is this one. Oh. It's just a nice scripture reference supporting the same point. It's a... Krishna says it in Bhagavad Gita, without faith, mogasya moga karma no mogam jnana vicheta saha. You're going to be defeated in everything that you do if there isn't faith. And if there is faith, then you can achieve the fullness of what you're receiving. So, she has that faith. Tens of thousands of years of being with her qualified husband to see he's worthy of my placing my full faith in him. She has it. And he's given some instruction, so it's not, oh, that was a nice instruction, and her mind goes elsewhere. She's going to carry out the instruction in full faith. That's another point in that Bhagavat Mahatmya, right? That reference. Okay, so that was text 5. Text 6. Tasyam Bahutite Kale. After many, many years, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Madhusudana, the killer of the demon Madhu, having entered the semen of Kardama, appeared in Devahuti, just as fire comes from wood in a sacrifice. Purport. Why should I clarify? It is clearly stated here that the Lord is always the Supreme Personality of Godhead, although he appeared as the son of Kardama Muni. Fire is already present in wood. But, by a certain process, fire is kindled. Similarly, God is all-pervading. He's everywhere. And since he may come out from everything, he appeared in his devotee's semen, just as an ordinary living entity takes its birth by taking shelter of the semen of a certain living entity. The Supreme Personality Godhead accepts the shelter of the semen of his devotee and comes out as his son. This manifests his full independence to act in any way, and it does not mean that he is an ordinary living entity forced to take birth in a certain type of womb. Lord Nrisimha appeared from the pillar of Hiranyakashipu's palace. Lord Varaha appeared from the nostril of Brahma. And Lord Kapila appeared from the semen of Karnava. But this does not mean that the nostril of Brahma, or the pillar of Hiranyakashipu's palace, or the semen of Kardamuni is the source of the appearance of the Lord. The Lord is always the Lord. Bhagavan Madhusudanaha. He is the killer of all kinds of demons, and he always remains the Lord, even if he appears as the son of a particular devotee. The word kardamam is significant, for it indicates that the Lord has some devotional affection or relationship in devotional service with kardama and devahuti. But we should not mistakenly understand that he was born just like an ordinary living entity from the semen of kardamuni in the womb of devahuti. The verse again. After many, many years, oh, it's the Sanskrit. Tasyam bahutate kave bhagavan madhusudanaha kardamam viryam. Virya means his semen. Virya means strength. Here it's his semen. Kardamam viryam apano entered. Yagyagnir iva dharani in the wood. Just like fire appears in wood. When describing Krishna's appearance, because we just observed Krishna Janmashtami, again and again Prabhupada makes the point that Krishna did not appear by the normal procedure, seminal injection in the womb of the mother, etc., etc. He appeared in the mind of Vasudeva, transferred to the mind of Devaki, and then in the womb of Devaki, and then he appeared. But he appeared in the mind of Devaki from Vasudeva. From where did he appear? He appeared from his heart, but of course he can appear from anywhere. Like he can appear in a pillar, and he can, however he wants to appear. Remember, as a new devotee, reading first canto and pondering over the appearance of Lord Vishnu or Krishna giving protection to Maharaj Parikshit within the womb. So the question I was pondering is, where did he appear from and where did he go to? And I speculated or thought, maybe from the heart of Maharaj Parikshit, he left the heart of Maharaj Parikshit and appeared before Maharaj Parikshit. And then didn't know if that was correct or not. And then went back to the heart. But, and go further and further with that question, and he doesn't have to appear from anywhere. And then go back to that someplace that he appeared from. As if, he left place A to go to place B, and then he's in place B, and then he goes back to place A, because he's all-pervading. All-pervading means all-pervading. Exactly as Prahlad said to Hiranyakashipu, where is your Vishnu? He's everywhere. Is he in this pillar? He's in the pillar. He's everywhere. He's in the pillar. So, from where did Lord Narasimha appear? from the pillar, but from anywhere. Not necessarily from the pillar. He came out of the pillar. And with Lord Ramachandra's appearance, this whole similar discussion in Srimad Bhagavatam, in the that first chapter 10, I think it is, canto 9, where the appearance of the four brothers, Prabhupada covers the same point. Same point. He's in the heart of every living entity. He's everywhere. And so his appearance was by his volition, not by some yajna, and then the payasam was given to the queens, and then it was made possible. That's a pastime to give some service to his devotees, and to give some opportunity for those who are mundane to think, oh, he's one of us. He appeared like one of us. Just like Krishna's departure. Specifically, elaborate discussion on Krishna's departure was to bewilder the atheists so they could think, oh, he's one of us. Although our acharyas are very careful, very, very careful to make sure we don't make that mistake of thinking he's one of us. In the canto 9, chapter 10, Prabhupada, in a series of purports, says some scholarly person tried to argue that Ramchandra is one of us. He's not the personality of Godhead. And, you know, what of this, how the process of his birth took place is obviously one of the evidences to say he's one of us. Therefore, acharyas, in our case, Srila Prabhupada in his commentary, wants to have us understand he's not one of us. He's transcendental. Just another sharing on this same point. Before Prabhupada translated Krishna book, we heard from him over and over and over and over. He was preparing us for eventually meeting impersonalists. We didn't even know what a Mayavadi was. It sounded like, you know, an extinct species, a dinosaur or something. But he kept speaking about it, and one of the, you know, strong concerns was people that would go to the 10th canto, the Bhagavad reciters, unscrupulously describe Krishna's pastimes. They don't understand anything about Krishna. And they would speak of him as one of us, and then they would get people to imitate them and exploit women. You know, they're just rascals. Strong, over and over and over. And then came Krishna book. You know, I found it very puzzling. He spoke so strongly against going to the 10th canto, and then did the 10th canto, and not only that, had us go out into the public and pass out zillion Krishna books. Why did he do that? Well, you read Krishna book and it's really clear why he did that, but he explicitly said, I don't know how long I will live. And while popularizing bhakti, I don't want people to then go to the 10th canto and do what the unscrupulous people do. I want to give a clear understanding of Krishna. So, again and again and again and again and again and again, in so many different ways, multiple ways, Krishna is not an ordinary person. So many ways. Not an ordinary person. It's very strong in this is the prayers of the demigods, chapter 2. It's in canto 10, but it's also in Krishna book, chapter 2. Again and again. But throughout, like Krishna is not an ordinary. Don't read or hear the activities and pastimes and form of Krishna as if he's an ordinary person. He's not an ordinary person. Here's the reasons why you should be convinced. So now back to this purport, Kardamuni. The verse says that the Supreme Lord, because Kardamuni said to Devahuti, the Supreme Lord will become your son. Meditate upon him with full devotion, with full faith, and he will appear as your son. Now, there was a procedure for him to appear as his son, but it had to do with the affection of Kardama for the Supreme Lord and his service to Lord Brahma as a Prajapati. And so the conception of Kapila Dev appeared to be like a Prajapati would do. But it's not on the platform of just a Prajapati. Like, Daksha was a Prajapati. And, you know, he had some problems. Kardamuni, they're brothers. They're sons of Brahma. Kardamuni didn't have those problems. But he performed the activities just like before before Kapila Dev was born or conceived. There were daughters, and daughters born in a similar manner. Now, where those souls come from, going to the standard procedure, we can understand. In this case, Kapila Dev, he appeared, from where did he come? And after his pastime drove, where did he go to? He's everywhere. He didn't have to come from anywhere, because he's everywhere. It's an interesting solution to an apparent dilemma or a material conception. He doesn't have to come from anywhere. Now, it says, having entered the semen of Kardama, Prabhupada writes in the purport, he may come out from everything. He appeared in his devotee semen, just as an ordinary living entity takes birth by taking shelter of the semen of a certain living entity. The personality of Godhead accepts shelter of the semen of his devotee, comes out of his son. This manifests his full independence to act in any way. And it does not mean that he was an ordinary living entity forced to take birth in a certain womb. Then these examples, Lord Nrisimha, Lord Varaha, from the nostril of Brahma. Interesting. It's similar to, not the same as, but similar to Canto 1, Chapter 3, where the question that's by the sages to Sutta is, describe the forms of the Lord as they appear in this world. So chapter 3, it starts with the Vishnu forms, the Purusha avatars, because they're in this world. They're not in Goloka or Vaikuntha. They're manifestations from the purpose of creation. And then from then comes avatars of Vishnu. And then the statement of all these avatars of Vishnu, one is the source of all of them, including Vishnu. That's Krishna. So Krishna can appear however he wants to appear. No problem. That he appears as an avatar of Vishnu doesn't mean he's, you know, subordinate to Vishnu. This is discussed in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Vishnu has four arms, Krishna has two arms, that means Vishnu is greater. It's quite foolish. Rather, Krishna appears however he likes. Just as Lord Nrisimhadev appeared and Lord Brahma appeared and Kardama being the father, Kapila Dev appeared. Krishna appeared in the mind of Vasudeva. However he likes. And it's in different situations, it's just simply a reciprocation of love with his devotee. He appears this way, appears that way, in a mood of love with his devotee. So, having kardama, having a particular assignment from his father, he appeared the way that he appeared. Then, two other points. Prabhupada remarks about Bhagavan Madhusudana, because that's in the verse, Bhagavan Madhusudana, killer of the demon Madhu. And when he's the killer of the demon Madhu, he doesn't descend to a worldly position, because oh, now he's contacting a demon. When Krishna or Vishnu or the forms of the Lord appear in this world, they don't become contaminated by the world. They purify the world. And then the various... So this is this nice verse from chapter 4 Bhagavad Gita. Janma karma chame divyam. So how to understand that? Read the commentary and it explains that. So when he appears as Madhusudana, he's not worldly. That's otherworldly. That's a pastime. He could have had Madhu killed any number of different ways, but he did it personally for the sake of Brahma. Brahma appealed, and he came, and he did because of that relationship with Brahma. But he doesn't become worldly. Or take it the other way. It's not mythology. He always remains the Lord, even if he appears as the son of a particular devotee. And then the last message of the purport, the word kardamam, because that's in the third line, kardamam viryam avano. Kardamam is significant, or in any case, that if that the Lord had some devotional affection or relationship in devotional service with Kardama and Devahuti. Normally we think of devotional service as something that we do for Krishna. But you shouldn't forget that it's Krishna accepts the position of his devotee and feels great affection for his devotee. I'm trying to recall the section. Just discussed it somewhere in Ypsilanti, Michigan. The section of the Bhagavatam. Can't remember which section. But the message was the Supreme Lord feels such affection for his devotee that he places himself in a subordinate position to his devotee. Ah, I remember. It's when Lord Narayana comes to the gates of Vaikuntha after there's this exchange between the four Kumaras and Jayavijay, he says a number of things. First, he offers his apology to the four Kumaras, and he says the offense that was created is my offense because they're acting on my behalf. So someone's acting on your behalf. If they make an offense, it's the person who they're serving's offense. So I accept the offense. I'm the perpetrator of this offense, so please forgive me. Then he says something very interesting. important. It's related to this. He says, people are searching after my lotus feet. The reason they are is because of great devotees like you. O four Kumaras, you're such great devotees that therefore my feet have become honored by others. And even the goddess of fortune, she's always at my feet because of the devotion of persons like you. So you've made me famous. He's attributing his fame to his devotee. So I'm so indebted to you. And there's other places with the same thing. When Tarasamuni goes to Lord Vishnu, and Lord Vishnu says the same thing to Tarasamuni. It's important to understand, bringing this up, because it's important to understand the nature of the person that we're serving. He feels affection in amazing ways for those who have affection for him. Unfortunately, some people don't understand that, or they don't have faith, or they see God as their order supplier, and when things don't go the way they want them to go, why did God forsake me? Circumstances get tough. Why did God forsake me? I'm a good devotee. I try to do everything in the right way. Why do I have this ordeal or circumstance? And blame God. Anyway, it's a poor understanding of the nature of the personality of Godhead and how he interacts with his loving devotee. Tribulation doesn't mean neglect or harsh dealing. It's in Lord Brahma's prayers where this nice saying, difficulty may come for the devotee. Sometimes, this is Vishwanath says, sometimes a loving father will embrace his son, and sometimes he will scold him sternly. Sometimes a loving father will give milk and sweet rice to his son. Sometimes he gives him bitter nimba juice. Doesn't mean in one case he's loving and affectionate, in the other case he's not. There are different dealings from the father to the son according to the circumstance. The son may not understand. But a loving father is a loving father. If it's called for, he'll give something, some bitter medicine. The nature of the Supreme, in this case it's Kapila Deva, is he's very loving. And he's loving because of the affection of his devotee, in this case Karnama. So he appears as a son, and appears as the son of Devahuti. But, concluding part of the purport, we shouldn't think, therefore, he's ordinary, one of us, just look, just see. Not like that. Now it takes faith and it takes a qualified person to explain things. In this case, Prabhupada in his commentary, but I'm sure it's in line with the previous acharyas in their commentary. How do you understand something properly? Through this process of descending knowledge. Any discussion? Thinking about Sridhar Swami, I'll just say, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted that the qualified commentator on Srimad Bhagavatam was Sridhar Swami. Interesting. Sridhar Swami had in his life history, he had some involvement with Shankar's followers. Yet he had strong connection with the Madhva followers, and they're diametrically opposite. So Jiva Goswami explains, Sridhar Swami had a strategy, because Sridhar Swami knew that Shankaracharya posted or wrote 10 verses glorifying the personality of Godhead, Govinda, Govindastakam, citing pastimes that are only found in Srimad Bhagavatam, which means Shankaracharya was familiar with Srimad Bhagavatam, but he never made commentary on it. Sridhar Swami was concerned. Followers of Shankaracharya may later try to make commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam and screw it up. But we mislead people. And, parallel, because they have some fascination for Srimad Bhagavatam, let me make a commentary that there are some places that appear to be impersonal, because otherwise they're not going to read the literature at all. But primarily it's Vaishnava. And so that's what he did. So Jiva Goswami comments, this is in Taittira-samhita, that my principal reference is Srimad Bhagavatam, the principal commentary is Sridhar Swami, and I only make reference to those that are consistent with the views of Vyasadeva and Shukadeva Goswami. Those are my principal references. So, how did Sridhar Swami get the capacity to make commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam? Where did he hear? Who did he hear from? You just go up the line from Madhvacharya. So, and Madhvacharya had it as a special gift, as some persons may have a special gift from the personality of Godhead. He verified, Madhvacharya verified his conclusions with the Vyasadeva. So, the process of disciplic succession must be honored. But someone may be qualified, as, for example, the six Goswamis, to directly experience Krishna's pastimes, enter into Krishna's pastimes, even during their very lifetime. One is so eminently qualified that it can happen. But they'll never deviate from the essence given to them by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They'll be faithful and with fidelity to that conclusion. So, comments, discussion? Yeah?
You said in the beginning one of the main principles of bhakti is complete faith. And so I'm kind of wondering how one can
get that
for faith that allows one,
it's gradual. Faith doesn't, it's not on and off, it's not a zero or a ten. It's cultivation. And cultivation, how do we cultivate faith? There's multiple methodologies or principles. One of them is you act in knowledge. You receive, you act according to what you've received, and something happens. You get a realization, and then, now let me go back. Just like going to a doctor. It's qualifying. You're not sure. You're going to the doctor because there's some faith, but you're not sure what's going to happen. And then you take the medicine, follow the diet, etc., etc., and there's improvement of health. So, you act in knowledge. It increases faith. You get some realization, it increases faith. That's one. Associate with persons who are faithful is another. And avoid the other kind, or at least intimate association with the other kind. That's another, through association. Another is gradual evolving, just through Prabhupada's phrases, ardent hearing, the sound vibration coming from a proper source itself is purifying. So gradually, that which is not clean can become clean by contact with the Supreme Pure, the heart and the mind.
So even indirectly, whatever we do that's devotional service because it's purifying will indirectly also help that.
Yes. And it's proportionate to one's sincerity. That is, I want to, I don't know, I'm not there, but I want to be there. I want to come to that position. Like Rupa Goswami teaches, the eligibility is sincerity. I'm not with a full faith. I have some faith. And I, you know, look inside, and I just got this letter from somebody saying, you know, I still have doubts whether Krishna is God. I'm serving him and I'm doing devotional service, but you know, I have from time to time these doubts arise. That's in itself not a problem. Just like Arjuna has his doubts, and you bring the doubts to the light of knowledge, and then they can be addressed. Doesn't mean that, oh, okay, now it's gone. We're deeply involved in contamination, not just from this lifetime. So, therefore, sincerity means I recognize where I am, and I know where I want to be, and I don't have full faith in even the means to get there, what to speak of the goal. But let me, I want that. There's sincerity. Intention is another. Sankalpa, another. And then faith can incrementally grow. We have to connect with the right source. And who are we? You know, we're less than perfect, so we're acting according to our discrimination capacity and our faith.
As we go through that kind of gradual evolution, should we be very concerned about evaluating whether or not this faith that I think I'm developing is becoming more sentimental?
Yeah, we should be introspective every step. And we're less than perfect, and so we're going to make judgments about that question and others that aren't, you know, they need refinement. It's imprecise. But yes, we should always be introspective. Not too much this way, not too much that way. Not too much harsh on ourselves, not too much, you know, liberal and say, oh, I'm there.
So a symptom of the balance.
Symptom?
Measuring whether or not it's balance.
Well, steadiness is one.
Steadiness is
yeah, a desire to be in service. Bhakti. A desire to be in service. Is it waning or is it strengthening?
Desire to go back to Godhead like this lifetime, or you should just think like, oh,
I read a Back to Godhead article so many years ago, I don't remember when it was, and Prabhupada was a lecture, and he was indicating that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu spoke a certain way and devotees in the beginning stage aren't there. So, for us, it's good to desire to go back to Godhead. It's impetus, because otherwise, well, kesara sara, whatever. We should desire to be with Krishna. And as bhakti matures, Krishna, you can do with me whatever you like. But I desire to be with you. And I'll be with you wherever I have devotion, not, you know, some geographic location. It's a devotional capacity. So in the beginning, we should desire to go back to Godhead in this lifetime. That's again and again and again and again and again and again in Prabhupada's purports, in this very lifetime. That's the promise, that's the gift. And in other places, after this lifetime, will it be easier or more difficult? Kali Yuga will progress. It'll be more difficult. Just even during our short lifetime, it's more difficult. It's crazy out there. So, finish up your business in this lifetime. At the beginning, we should have that aspiration. Not in the liberationist mood, getting out of here, this place is crazy, but in the devotional mood, I want to be with Krishna. I'll serve Krishna in separation, but that don't be complacent. I want to be with Krishna. That's the mood of the associates of Krishna. I want to be with Krishna. That you know, I'm contented to be serving Krishna in any situation, but I want to be with him. However, that's to be done. Anything?
One question. You mentioned that in the Satyava the process was dhyana.
Mm.
So that triggered a thought in my mind, the question connected to that. Devotee said, whosoever is chanting holy names, that person has already gone through all the Vedic purificatory processes, has taken bath in the holy places, all those rites and rituals he or she has gone through. So, as a practicing devotee, I don't know my past life, whether I have gone through that or not. So is going through all those activities a qualification for being able to chant purely?
Well, here's two answers. And one is, it doesn't really matter. meaning, whether A or B, literally I've done all these things, or B, that by chanting in a quality way, the benefit to come from all those things is there. It can be A or B, it doesn't really matter. And one can take it this way, that's fine. One can take it that way, that's fine. What's the objective? Because without that objective, all those other things shall not be capable of. Another way of saying the same thing, which is basically saying the same thing, making dry wood, wet wood to dry wood before you ignite it. How are you going to get wet wood to ignite? You have to dry it. So whether the drying process is chant the holy name even when you're wet, or do these other things and it helps you become dry, and then you can ignite. One way to make wet wood dry is put it near a fire. You just, you know, wait until the sun comes out, like in Houston, until all the flooding goes away. I was in Houston, I don't know, but a week before this thing came, it was really hot. It was almost 100 degrees. It wasn't hot and humid. It was hot. So after this thing passes, it's going to get hot again. It'll dry up quickly after all the damage was done, the wind and the water and everything. So back to the question. Our focus, like the advice that's being given to Devahuti, is the process for the age. We follow it. And we don't ignore these other things. The austerity, the charity, the control of the mind. We don't ignore these other things. They're supports for this one thing. But the goal is chanting without offense. Rupa Goswami teaches any one of these five things, to do them without offense, bhava bhakti awakens at once. Oh, very powerful. Any one of them.
What five things?
From Nectar Devotion. Hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, serving the devotees, worshipping the deity, form of the Lord, chanting the holy name, residing in a sacred place. Without offense. It's sufficient to awaken bhava bhakti at once. Now, awakening or not awakening, that's up to Krishna. That's our position. We're his dependent. He can do with us whatever he wants. But the potency is there. So faith needs to be there in the instruction of Rupa Goswami. It's not just hyperbole. Not just pumping up the devotees so they can pay attention to those things. It's a fact. And therefore, striving to become free from offense is critical. Based on faith. Yeah?
What is the importance to stay in a holy place and actually in the Dham in India, or not even to stay, actually to visit those places? Or it's enough just to go to the temples even here in America, or make your home the temple.
Yes, that's what we do. And when you make the home your temple, or your home a temple, in the heart, hankering for being in Krishna's eternal place of pastimes. You know, not just geographically, but spiritually. You understand the distinction. Not just buy a ticket and go there and now you're, everything's good. But enter into the mood of the holy place by the power of bhakti. Hankering for that. And as your place of residence, not just a physical geographic location. Yeah? Hankering, if you're not able to. And same with visiting. Visiting is, you know, you can just see the external and not the Dham, per se. Yeah?
It sparked a question I've had for some time, where there's that phrase that one should model one's life in such a way that he can always remember Krishna.
Yes.
So is that very somewhat specific to individuals, to be introspective and self-reflective and sort of creative and trying to know whatever is helping inspire
of
that
course.
Mood?
Of course, of course.
It shouldn't try to be too stereotyped or necessary.
Well, then on the other hand, yes. And the rules and regulations are there for a reason. If you're not, you know, obsessed about rules and regulations, we want to be, you know, to get the essence of those rules and regulations. And then over there, the rules and regulations have a purpose. A resolution of that is, when one comes to the bhava stage, the spontaneous stage of devotion, then you may not follow those rules and regulations, and it's not an impediment. But otherwise, if there's some conflict of some ecstatic mood, one may not do something or do something that's violating a rule. Like the nice example, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya taking Mahaprasad before he got out of bed. And Mahaprabhu said, "Whoa, you're a smarter Brahmin, you know that's against the rules." And then his answer was, "Yes, it's against the rules, but here's a higher rule. Immediately you should accept." So you can violate one of these regulations in a spontaneous mode of devotion. Or, there's another one related to prasadam. Devotees snatching prasadam from another devotee's plate. And Prabhupada said, oh, that's nice. We have faith in prasadam. But it doesn't mean, oh, therefore we should snatch. We're respectful. Kuntaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.